I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. There's a push on Capitol Hill to make Puerto Rico the 51st state. The bill introduced last week by Congressman Darren Soto, a Democrat from Central Florida, has bipartisan support, including from the resident commissioner of Puerto Rico, Jennifer Gonzalez. But there's also pushback from some who say a statehood bill ignores the will of the residents of Puerto Rico. Coming up, we'll talk to Congressman Soto about why he thinks this path to statehood would be the best option for Puerto Rico, and we'll talk to Marcos Villar, who says the bill is the antithesis of democracy. And we're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252. What do you think about the idea of Puerto Rico as the 51st state? And your comments and questions on Twitter as well, at WMFE Orlando.
Well, joining us in the studio is Marcos Villar. He's the President and Executive Director of the Alianza for Progress. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthew.
And just a reminder, you can call in if you have thoughts on the idea of Puerto Rico as the 51st state, statehood for the island. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Also taking your comments and questions on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. We'll speak to Congressman Soto shortly, but first, Marcos, you wrote in an opinion piece for the Orlando Sentinel, you called the bill introduced by Congressman Soto the antithesis of democracy. I wonder if you could unpack that a little bit for us. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, the history of Puerto Rico has been very contentious, and, you know, how to solve the status issue in Puerto Rico has been contentious for the 120 years that Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States. I think that, you know, what I was trying to communicate here is that this bill is predicated on a referendum that took place in 2017, where statehood had over 90% favorability in that referendum. But what most people don't know about that referendum is that it was a referendum set up by one party, the statehood party, pro-statehood party, and that this referendum was boycotted by all the other parties in Puerto Rico and the citizens of Puerto Rico. It only had 23% participation when historically in Puerto Rico, every election and every referendum has had over 70% of participation.
So just so I'm clear, other referenda on the issue of state, and I assume there have been more before this, they were
50-50.
Right, so they were instituted in collaboration with the other parties in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, there's always, you know, controversy and debate in these referenda, but the previous choices were defined together with the other parties. The one previous to this, there was the statehood party defined the terms, and the opposition did not like the terms, so they put up an option, none of the above. And as a way to sort of give an option of dissent, the legislature at that point accepted. They didn't think that that option would win, but actually none of the above won the referendum.
Just so I'm clear, and for the benefit of our listeners who maybe aren't following this story as closely as obviously you and many other people of Puerto Rican origin in Central Florida would be, are all of the political parties in Puerto Rico affiliated with one or other of these movements for either independence, remaining territory, or statehood?
There have been historically three major parties, two major parties. One is the pro-statehood party. The other one is the Commonwealth, basically accepting the status quo. And then there's been a smaller party that has been historically participating in the elections as the Independence Party, which usually gets between 3-5% of the vote. Throughout history, there's been many other fourth and fifth parties that have come up at different times. Some of them favor statehood, some of them favor independence, but maybe on a more radical socialist perspective. But they have gained very little support. Those new, you know, third and fourth and fifth parties are parties that minority parties, very, you know, very small slices of the electorate. What we do have is that in the last election, we had two additional parties participated, new parties, and there was two additional independent candidates running for governor.
And was this partly because of what happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria?
No, this election took place before the hurricane,
right?
And so there has been discouragement with the way the traditional, the two major parties have conducted. And I think that there's a growing sector of the electorate that's looking for an alternative that does not get us. People are tired of the status debate, and they want to. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a vein starting to form, political vein starting to form, that says we need to work with our economy, build up our economy, because whether we want to be independent or a state, if we don't have a strong economy, it's going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. It's going to be difficult to get the United States to accept Puerto Rico as a state if the economy is so devastated. So we have to build the economy. We have to, you know, get Puerto Rico to be strong and appealing, you know, say, you know, we have to do what other states do. Or if you want to be independent, you know, it's I think, you know, obviously everybody's going to reject independence to go into independence in poverty. Who wants to try out independence in a very impoverished situation?
So if the issue then is the Puerto Rican economy and building that up and infrastructure and all of those other things, that seems like it would push the solving the question or answering the question of the status of Puerto Rico down the road quite some way.
So it could if it takes a long time to fix the economy, but the economy could perhaps be improved pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's ways to do that, and we are, and as long as we're part of the United States and the United States recognizes its sovereignty over Puerto Rico, which the Supreme Court has and the Congress does and everybody else in the United States does, then there is a responsibility on behalf of the United States to take care of these citizens that are in mm-hmm. Puerto Rico and to build our economy.
Well, I want to bring into this conversation Congressman Darren Soto. I believe he's on the line now. Congressman Soto, are you there, sir?
Yes, Matthew.
Thank you so much.
Marcus,
thank you so much for joining us. Yes, and I appreciate you doing this. I know you've got an event to be at out in Polk County. So let me ask you a little bit about the motivation for this bill at this point in time. You're in your second term of Congress now. Why is now the time to push for statehood, and why is this the way to go about it, do you think?
Because the territorial status is killing the island, and we don't have to look any further than the terrible response to Hurricane Maria, the PROMESA fiscal board that is cutting the heck out of the budget, and I have come to the conclusion after seeing two elections where we had statehood as the choice, that Puerto Rico would be better served with four members of Congress and two senators fighting for them. And the other thing is we have to take these plebiscites seriously. You know, we've had two of them already, and you know, the reality is President Trump is for the territorial status. So while this bill may move somewhat in the House, it may have problems in the Senate, and ultimately we may find ourselves with another question on the ballot in 2020 before we actually get this resolved. But, I certainly don't have a problem with independence. I know that's a position Marcos has, too. It's just that hasn't really taken off in Puerto Rico. And so statehood has been the one that has had two elections supporting it. And I do think we...
Can I just interrupt there for a moment? What about that idea of the fact that the most recent referendum wasn't really an accurate representation of what the people who live in Puerto Rico want because so many people boycotted the referendum?
So that position caused us to have to ignore elections, which we don't do in this country. It would allow, if we recognize people not voting, then it would undercut every election in American history. You know, we had a governor and a legislature put out a ballot that tracked the three choices, statehood, territory, or independence. The biggest objection seems to be among folks who want the current status. They hate the term territory. They want to have this enhanced commonwealth, which doesn't exist under the Constitution. It's deceptive in nature, or they just were worried that they were going to lose. So if we give intent to people boycotting elections, then you can undermine every election. And so I don't have a problem with if people wanted independence or people wanted statehood or if there was a majority of folks voting for Commonwealth, which there hasn't been in a long time. But it seems like with this fear that one of these may prevail out, there's always these underhanded tactics to try to twist it. now we'll probably have another election where it'll either be statehood, yes or no, or it'll be statehood, territory, or independence. But what we can't have is these fanciful phrases to try to make territorial status sound better, like enhanced commonwealth, which doesn't exist. And that's my worry about these things. You know that. And I was there as a part of a bipartisan group to oversee the election. I didn't have a position before that. My real motivation has always been that I want to help out the island. And when we see that this territorial status is killing the island, we need to have a resolution of this. And the people of Puerto Rico need to know that if they have an election, Congress will respond to them. And that's where this idea of boycotts and allowing people to attack things after the fact is just contrary to the foundation of our democracy.
We're listening to Congressman Darren Soto there talking about his bill to make Puerto Rico a state. You can join the conversation too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Send us a tweet as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Brandon writes, if Puerto Ricans voted for statehood, would the mainland Republicans authorize it? They're all about restricting votes that are possibly against their belief structure. Well, that's an opinion, I guess, but there is a question in there, is there not, about the, I guess, the appetite, the mood for people who don't have a connection to Puerto Rico and maybe don't have a lot of constituents in their districts who have an interest in this. Congressman Soto, what kind of task is it to sell this idea to your fellow lawmakers, and how are you going to go about doing that?
So the bill is bipartisan. We have Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, the commissioner of Puerto Rico's Republican, Don Young, the longest-serving member of Congress, a Republican who's supportive. We have lots of Democrats, obviously, supportive. You saw some of them come out at the meeting. So I think we'll see some movement in the House, but in the Senate, you have two Republican senators representing our state, Senator Scott and Rubio, who said they're for statehood, but we really haven't seen much movement yet on that. And undoubtedly, we have a president who is for the territorial status. President Trump does not support statehood. I've never heard him talk either way on independence.
Well, is that something that you know for a fact, or is it just that it hasn't really, you haven't really sort of delved into it? I mean, have you sat down and had a conversation with him about it?
Several newspapers have quoted President Trump as saying he's against statehood. So I'm basing it on that. I have never had a conversation with President Trump about that or anything else personally, by that matter. He doesn't really speak to a lot of Democrats. But the key is you're going to see some movement in the House on D.C. statehood, and we need to treat folks in Puerto Rico equally if we're going to be pushing for D.C. statehood as well. And so, and as Representative Raskin, a constitutional expert who's a supporter of the bill and one of the heads of the Progressive Caucus, has mentioned, these things are usually done two by two. It presents for an opportunity, and we've been getting attacked with Democrats for supporting D.C. statehood, but ignoring two elections in Puerto Rico. So it really was a question of consistency as well. But there's no doubt there'd be a tough road through the Senate, and then we may face a veto. But it also serves as a motivation that have this question hammered out for the 2020 election, when you'll have huge turnout, and then we need to respect the election, because whether it's independence or whether it's statehood, those things will resolve the problem. But the current territorial status is putting Puerto Rico in this situation that is playing out in horrifying detail on the radio, on TV, and in images across the nation about what's happening down there.
Well, Congressman Soto, please stay on the line if you would. Let me come back to you for a moment, Marcos Villar. This idea of enhanced territorial status, I mean, what do you make of that? Is there any legs in that, or as the congressman says, is that something that is just completely untenable?
Look, I mean, to give you an example that's currently, law, is the PROMESA law. PROMESA law is a very anti-democratic law. It places the entire budget of Puerto Rico under a seven-person board. It was sort of forced on Democrats by Republicans, and it was forced on the people of Puerto Rico because of the financial situation in Puerto Rico. But the reason this vote passed and was there was able to get consensus between Republicans and Democrats because Puerto Rico does not have bankruptcy. And in order,
unlike states which might find themselves,
and
in
Puerto Rico was
defaulting
on their debt, and mm-hmm. and the creditors were going to be coming into Puerto Rico to, you know, sue Puerto Rico for damages based on the outstanding debt, which meant, you know, Puerto Rico could go up for sale or basically could be handed over to the creditors piece by piece, you know, building by building, agency by agency. And you know, it's really a contradictory law to what democracy is in this country, completely contradictory. And the Congress has a lot of contradictions in their laws. So the fact that a definition could come up that was more that gave Puerto Rico a larger amount of self-rule, mm-hmm. that is a possibility, I think. And for 120 years, we've been told that it's a possibility and it's been an option. So I think that the key here, and I don't disagree with Puerto Ricans having the choice to choose between statehood, you know, a greater form of self-rule, mm-hmm. or independence. They should choose whatever it is that they and the election should be binding. None of the elections before have been binding.
How do you make
they
the election not. Binding then?
Congress has to commit mm-hmm. to accept whatever, and there has the definitions have to be agreeable to Congress and to the United States, and they have to be agreeable to the people of Puerto Rico too. The definitions of the election, mm-hmm. that would be a fair decolonizing process for Puerto Rico, and that's what we're asking for. We're not saying that it has to be independent, that it has to be an enhanced form of Commonwealth. I think the answer is we either go in the direction of self-rule or we go in the direction of integration, complete full integration into the United States. Those mm-hmm. are, you know, ultimately the two options that we have. But I think that in history, mm-hmm. we don't, you know, in the history of elections in Puerto Rico, we don't have any clear indication that we're leaning one way or the other. And in that sense, the definitions are important, and we have to define those definitions acceptable to both Congress and the people of Puerto Rico and then make it binding. Mm-hmm. And then we decide, and whatever the answer is, we all have, like the congressman says, we abide by the results.
Mm-hmm. I want to get a call in here. We've got William calling in. William, what are your thoughts on the idea of Puerto Rico as a state, another state of the United States?
Hey, thank you for allowing me to be on the show. I appreciate sure. that. I am Puerto Rican. I was born and raised in Caguas, Puerto Rico, and I live here now in Florida, but I actually go back and forth, and I truly believe that Puerto Rico needs to become a state. Like the other guy is saying, we need to make a decision. It's like there's not a clear decision on this. They're like not even in the middle yet. Everybody's kind of confused where to go, but I truly believe Puerto Rico needs to become a state. I am tired, and a lot of our family are tired of being in the same exact position for many years. Mm-hmm. No jobs. There's not a strong economy in Puerto Rico, and we just tired of the broken system, mm-hmm. and we need to actually pay attention to what's going on. Jennifer Gonzalez addressed this a couple of years ago, I believe. I mean, Puerto Rico voted at like 62%. Mm-hmm. To become a state. A lot of people want the island to become a state. But we need to focus and hit it right in the middle.
Right.
I truly believe that a lot of Puerto Ricans are happy that Mr. Trump is president, you know, mm-hmm. and I think there will be a great communication between the president of the United States and Puerto Rico. So I am voting for Puerto Rico to become a state, and I truly believe what the guy is saying right now. It's true to believe we got to become as strong in the economy first, mm-hmm. and also we got to rebuild our system. The laws are broken.
Right.
People are just tired of the same old of the laws here and the people, the corruption, what's going on here. That's a big thing here.
Well, thank you so much for weighing in there, William. Hearing you loud and clear, statehood gets your vote. Congressman Soto, I know you've got to go in a minute or two. I just want to bring you back for this and ask for your reaction on that. I mean, it sounds like our caller, William, there had some kind of positive thoughts, at least, about the idea of that this could be an opportunity for the president to say, look, here's here's something we can do to improve the lot of folks on the island of Puerto Rico. What do you say to that?
Well, we're certainly going to give them the opportunity to do so by seeing some movement in the House on the bill, and he'll have an opportunity to comment, as will our senators. But I also want to get back to the economic argument. I believe that the economy, the poor economy down there, is a symptom of the territorial status. They don't get equal federal benefits. Doing business down there is uncertain because they literally have export taxes and other things that affect them. The 936 exemption, which really stimulated the pharmaceutical industry down there, built up the economy, and then Washington just took that away and led to the current crisis. So we see a lot of the problems to begin with, and the Medicaid funding. They don't get equal Medicaid funding, so a lot of the debt built up was because they borrowed to sustain their Medicaid program. So there's no – the only requirement in the Constitution is – Congress shall admit new states. It's not even a full sentence. It ends with a semicolon. So these ideas that we need to have an economic level, or that we need to have all these requirements, are the same debates that were happening for years before. They debated whether a nation become a state, like Texas. Mm-hmm. They debated language, like New Mexico, California, and Arizona. They debated whether things needed to be contiguous, like Alaska and Hawaii. So there's always going to be these barriers put up, but the Constitution's pretty clear. It just takes a bill of Congress, but I think it's important that we have elections to support it. That's been traditional to our history. But these other things like economics or language or things like that are just imposed barriers that have no basis in the Constitution. And so that's important as we look at these things, to keep that perspective.
Well, Congressman Soto, I know you've got to run, but I do appreciate you joining us on Intersection and weighing in on the bill that you've proposed to make Puerto Rico the 51st state of the United States. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Matthew. Thanks, Marcos.
Thank you.
Well, Marcos, in the few minutes we have remaining here, a lot of complexity to sort of tease out there. It does seem to me, though, that this is not a quick fix thing. I mean, Puerto Rico, you know, the issues that the island is facing now is the result. It's not just the hurricane, right? I mean, there are many other things going on there, too. It's going to take some time to sort this all out.
Yeah, today's front page and yesterday is corruption, a very severe corruption case in the Department of Education. This party and this administration has been riddled, you know, throughout history of, you know, one of the most corrupt, organizations in the history of Puerto Rico, always having problems with corruption and millions of dollars in corruption. So I think that is something that President Trump is holding up against Puerto Rico. A lot of other people do as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that,
it's not just him. I mean, it's people who live there.
And to be fair, corruption doesn't just happen in Puerto Rico. Corruption happens in Florida. Corruption happens in New Jersey, in Chicago, in every city, and in every state of the country. I mean, corruption is an element of, I guess, of society.
Mm-hmm.
Government is supposed to try and curb that, I think, as a democratic process. But, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle. I don't know that the congressman obviously thinks that he has a chance in the House. I don't know that he does or that this bill does. I think it's going to be really difficult in the Senate. One of the reasons why it's going to be hard in the House is because, you know, to add members of Congress to Puerto Rico, you got to take them from another from states. So there's going to be several states that are going to lose out representatives that would go to Puerto Rico, and that has been a controversy and a challenge in the past. But the fundamental problem for us is democracy, and there has to be a fair vote, a vote that has definitions that are agreeable to the people of Puerto Rico if we're going to ask the people of Puerto Rico to pick their future.
Well, Marcos Vilar is the Executive Director of the Alianza for Progress. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Up next, Joni Sherm's father escaped the Nazis in Czechoslovakia. Sherm has published a new book about her father's life. That conversation when we return.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Joni Holzer-Schirm says her father was a gifted storyteller, but one thing he didn't like to talk about was his escape from Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. Schirm's new book, My Dear Boy, tells that story with the help of a trove of letters and other documents about her father.
Well, Joni Holzer-Schirm, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really honored to be here.
So this is your second book, right? My Dear Boy. It's a World War II story of escape, exile, and revelation, and it's about your father.
Correct. It's about my Czech father, and he was Jewish, and he was a young doctor, and in 1939, when the Nazis came in 80 years ago, he managed to escape. And he went back to Prague from, he was in the army unit and went back to Prague. And then he made his way to China, one of the few ports of call that were accepting Jewish refugees. And largely because the Japanese were at war with the Chinese mm-hmm. and they controlled the port of Shanghai and there was no requirement for visas there. So 20,000 European Jews made their way there. And he was there for 19 months. He went into the interior and worked as a doctor for an American Brethren hospital. And he went to Peking, Beijing, one day to get supplies for the hospital. And the Japanese blew up the railroad tracks where he had been. And so he was stranded there, but fate intervened. And he met my mother, who had been born in China of American missionaries. And they were married 5 weeks later, had a 60-year love affair, and I ended up growing up in Brevard County, where my father was a family doc. So this is his story, and it is a story of kind of against all odds at that point. He lost 44 relatives in the Holocaust, ultimately, my grandparents included. But he rebuilt a wonderful life in Melbourne, and he lived by a last wish that his father made for him that was discovered. After his death, my parents died within 2 days of each other in January of 2000, and my brother, sister, and I discovered a very large World War II letter collection. It turned out to be 400 letters by 78 writers, and it included 70 carbon copies of my father's own letters. Mm-hmm. And so I chose them as my inheritance and had them all translated from Czech or German, the languages they were in, and that's the basis of all my books that I'm writing now, is really what was discovered in the letters and told a much greater story than we had ever known.
Did you have access to other letters from your father as well? Like, had you seen some material from his time in China and during the war as well?
I never saw letters, but my father, in 1989, I interviewed him for 7 hours. He was a great storyteller, and I always loved how his stories made people happy and kind of go places. You know, stories are great to take you places you haven't been. And so I really did it for that. And I knew some of the stories. My brother, sister, and I knew that we knew that our parents' meeting story. It was a great story to always be able to tell. Nobody could top that for how your parents met. And we knew that our grandparents and our great-grandmother had died in the Holocaust until 1993, when Schindler's List came out, and I went over with my young son and to visit my parents from Orlando, and I asked my father, I realize now foolishly, to go see the movie with me. I knew that, you know, the Holocaust had been in his past and he hadn't talked about it a lot, and there was so much talk about it, I thought maybe this would help him talk to me about it. But he said no in a big strong way, but he sat down and he ended up typing a list of who he knew had perished from his family and where he thought they'd perished, what year, what death camp or concentration camp. So it was really the first time we knew how bad it had really been for him. Mm-hmm. And so the letters really bring forward so much because they represent his friends and family who either escaped like he did to places like London and, you know, around Great Britain, southern France, South America, America. Even in China, where he was writing some cousins and friends from, you know, in a different place in China. And so all of those voices and the ones that were trapped behind. So my grandparents, I have 44 letters of my grandparents and some other cousins and aunts and such. And so you really get the on-the-ground reporting of not only what's happening historically, but how they feel about it and their vulnerability. And I think that's part – it's a – timely and timeless story for people, because it really reflects you know, the world of today as much as then, and mm-hmm. it's through the voices in the letters. And so I try to use excerpts, but also use those, you know, the voices that my father as I heard it, both on recorded interviews and the letters and journals that he wrote.
You said your father was a good storyteller and he liked to kind of entertain people and take them places, but when you sat down and talked to him for that 7 hours, was that the first real conversation you'd had with him about the war and about what happened to his family?
It was really in terms of, he didn't, you know, again, he talked about, at that point, we still only knew that our grandparents and great-grandmother had died. So he talked a little bit about them. He talked about Prague, the place that he loved, friends that he had, growing up years, and then adventure stories is what I would call them. There wasn't, you know, there was some that are really meaningful now in terms of how he escaped, as an example, from the Czech army, which was a very interesting story. And he told me, he described the pants that he wore when he escaped, which mm-hmm. were riding breeches, so he could just kind of meld into the crowd. There were a lot of people that were still riding horses back then.
So how old was your dad when he got away?
My dad was 26 when he escaped that army unit. And so he had graduated from medical school, and he had worked a little bit, and then he had gone into what was the Czechoslovak compulsory service in the military at that time. So he was working as a doctor. When the Germans came in, March 15, 1939, there were two Czech army units that were kind of out there in the hinterland. He was near Hungary, really, in the Slovakia area. And so my father, as a doctor in the unit, one of his responsibilities was being able to inspect the meat that they were going to go and buy to feed the soldiers. And so he says in his story, he asked his driver, a man named Vaclav, who happened to just live near where they had ended up, he said, "Do you want to go home?" And of course, Vaclav said yes. And he said, "Okay, go get the car. We're going out." And he wrote an order to inspect the meat. And he said he wrote it in Czech because most Germans don't speak Czech. And he put stamps all over it because he said Germans love fancy stamps. And they went to the gate, and when they arrived at the gate, the German asked my father in German, which most Czechs speak German, and said, "You know, where's your order?" He handed it to him. The German said, "I can't read it. Can you read this?" My father said, "I could have read it without looking at it, but I read it to him." And the German guard clicked his feet and said, "All is in order. You can go." So when they left, then they were in, you know, great danger of being discovered, having escaped. So that's where he wore those pants, and he ends up making it back to Prague and tells me this whole story. Well, my parents passed away, and my brother, sister, and I were going through their things and, you know, picking things that we wanted individually. And my brother had chosen this very greatly carved, beautiful Chinese chest, and in the chest were linens. And he said, "Pick what you want out of these linens," to my sister and I. And when I opened one of the drawers, on the very bottom were these pants. And mm-hmm. because I'd interviewed him, I knew what they were right away. So I call them the escape pants, and they've been my inspiration as I've written the whole time, because they really give me hope. And he survived, and therefore we exist.
How did you find the letters and the other items?
The letters were the first thing that happened when my parents died. They died so quickly together of natural causes. We kind of put off having a memorial for them a little while, and big crowd came to the memorial. And then afterwards, my brother, sister, and I went back to their condo in Indy Atlantic and sat there and said, you know, where do we start? And we ended up starting with this little Chinese box that had been kind of out of our reach a lot of the time. And there were two of them. But so my brother went and got it and brought it back to the dining room table where we were sitting, and we opened it up, and there were these letters stuffed into it, probably 40 or 50 in that first box. So it began there, but it was in the other box it was full, and some other ones, and under the bed and in his study and everywhere. We had to really be careful.
And these are now part of a display at the Holocaust Center here in Orlando.
They are. The significance, I think, for what we learned from this history is really about displaced persons. So we all know the number of 11 million people, 6 million Jews, 5 million non-Jews killed in the Holocaust in a horrible way. But many, many families obviously were displaced all over the world. So my father's story is a universal and timely story to how we find ourselves. And so at the local Holocaust Center in Maitland is an exhibit called Displaced Person, and it features my father's story, and it uses it again to kind of universalize how vulnerable we all are. And in this community, we have many people who have been displaced, like the Cuban community, the Vietnamese, the Haitian, you know, and others. So a lot of people relate to the stories of how people feel when they lose their country, their culture, their family, in a real brutal way. I think it speaks to that, but it also speaks to the hope and going on and creating a great life. And that's what my father did. He lived by a wish. It was the first letter that I had translated was the last letter that my grandfather Arnash wrote my father. And it was 3 days before they were taken away by the Nazis. And in the wish, he said that he hoped that my father would not just use his profession of curing to garner wealth, but that he would become a benefactor for the suffering humanity. And that's the life that I saw my father, Dr. Oswald Holzer, in Melbourne, live that life. And many people have told me stories of his generosity and never charging him for medical service. And he volunteered his time at Florida Institute of Technology to start the healthcare program for the students. And he donated that time for 10 years to that school. And he used to do a lot for nursing homes. He was on boards that created the first affordable housing, the Trinity Towers in Melbourne, and the mental health clinic. So he really followed his father's lead. And my mother was a part of that also. Her name was Ruth Alice Holzer. So I think out of the great darkness and also a lot of times lives of hardship lead to incredible destinies. And that's what I want people to see. There's always hope there, and we have to work together in this life of ours and try and bring goodness into the mix of life.
Well, Joni Holzer-Schirm is the author of My Dear Boy, a World War II story of escape, exile, and revelation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joni Holzer-Schirm's new book is My Dear Boy, a World War II story of escape, exile, and revelation. Still to come on Intersection, the art of concert photography with Jen Cray. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Jen Cray is a concert photographer whose work appears in the Orlando Weekly and other publications. Cray says she got bitten by the photography bug early.
Well, I grew up taking pictures from the time that I was just itty-bitty, and it was a natural thing to combine it with my love of music. So once I kind of realized, probably around high school, college age, that that was like a thing, you could actually go and take pictures at concerts, It's like, how do I do that, you know? So then I just kind of started doing it.
Now, your Instagram feed is interesting because it's kind of like a trip through memory lane of all the bands that have come through Central Florida, pretty much.
Yeah.
And there's a photograph on there which is particularly interesting because it's like right around the time you just got a digital camera. Tell me about that one.
Oh, which one are you talking about? The Strokes? Yeah. That's probably 2004. Yeah, I grew up, you know, shooting on just old 35mm SLRs, hand-me-downs from my dad, my granddad, which posed a bit of a challenge shooting in the lighting conditions of concerts. So, you know, digital photography was just kind of coming around in those early years of the 2000s. So I got a digital camera, but it was a really cheap little thing. It wasn't even an SLR because I didn't even know those existed yet. I was, you know, get a digital and I'm good to go. And then I scored a photo pass for the Strokes. That was one of the first big shows I got a pass for. And this was right at kind of the peak of their popularity. And it was a garbage camera, but I tried to make the settings manual and change whatever I could and make it happen. And I got a couple of shots that I was happy with. But with that camera, I'm very happy with what I got.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and then you discover that they made digital SLRs and started getting into that.
Yes, and then I put them on a credit card and I got one. So once I knew that I could take what I knew from 35mm and apply it to digital and then not have the limitations of 24 exposures and one ISO, then I was super excited.
And you started out just as a fan with a camera.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, whatever. You know, certain artists didn't care if you brought cameras in. I shot a lot of Ani DiFranco shows when I was younger because she never seemed to care about photo passes. Although, ironically, the first real photo pass I was ever given was through Ani DiFranco. So that was kind of the beginning of everything.
And did you have a publication to sell the photographs to before you got that pass? Or did you just say, I'm going to get the pass and figure out what happens after that?
You know, that first photo pass, I don't think I did. No, I don't remember how I scored it. I think I was just very honest. This was in 1997 was the first time I got that pass. So even the internet was still pretty new at the time, which is crazy. But I managed to get a hold of, you know, the right person to contact. And I just kind of said, I'm a big fan. I love taking pictures. Can I take pictures at this show? And I scored it. After that, then you had to have a publication that you were connected to. So then I started getting hooked up with that.
So did you grow up in Central Florida?
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in DeLand in Orange City.
What was the music scene like when you were a teenager?
Locally around there, there was a lot of little punk bands, a lot of folk music. I had a lot of friends that were in the folk music scene. So I did a lot of just shooting friends at coffee shops and things like that. But it seems like it's gotten a little bigger since my days back then.
What was the first concert you went to?
First concert ever?
Yeah.
I was 4 years old. And it was Cheap Trick opening up for REO Speedwagon.
Wow.
And my parents took me to it, and I was very, very young. And I think it was too loud for me at the time, and I think I made my parents leave after Cheap Trick because it was just way too loud, which I've since apologized for.
You remember it, though?
I remember seeing, I remember the visuals of it. I remember the crazy guitars with the multiple necks and all of that. I do have a distinct visual of that. I think it was probably at, you know, the Orlando Arena, whatever it was called back in those days.
Oh, the one that got blown up?
The old one, yeah. But that was my first concert officially. First concert I went to without my parents on my own was Lenny Kravitz with Blind Melon.
The heyday of 90s music.
Yeah, yeah. Those were my concert days, yeah.
It's interesting, though, that your first memory of that concert when you were four, what you remember about is the visuals, and now that's sort of what you take out of...
I mean, never made that connection.
Do you think that had some influence, though? I mean, it sounds like you grew up sort of surrounded by music. Your parents are obviously into it.
Yeah, I guess so. And even shows I went to as a kid, just, you know, little teeny bopper shows at the arena. I remember seeing the photographers getting escorted out and just being like, how do I get down there? How do I do that? And trying to just figure it out.
What are some of the most memorable shows you've been to? I mean, you've been to so many, but what are some that really stick out in your mind?
Oof. Some of the most memorable would probably be ones that are bands that I personally really, really like. I'm a huge White Stripes fan. Anything Jack White does, actually. So the first time I was able to photograph the White Stripes was at Bonnaroo in 2007. No, actually, it was 2005 at Music Midtown. It all gets confused in my head. But it was just, that was huge for me. And that's something I'll never forget. Another show I will never, ever forget was Morrissey. Being a girl growing up in the 80s and 90s, that was huge for me. And that was probably one of the few times I've been kind of starstruck in the photo pit. Just, you know, to me, he's like a god. So that was huge. Lately, I've been seeing a lot of those 80s reunion shows coming through. One that comes to mind, because I just posted a photo of it yesterday, was The Killers. I had shot them very early on, right after their first album, before they got popular. And then I just saw them recently at the Hard Rock, when now, of course, they're huge. The rest of their tour was arena shows. So it's totally different I prefer to see a band than to shoot a band when they're right at that cusp, when they're just about to make it and they're still hungry for it and they're still excited for it. They haven't yet gotten jaded. And on the reunion shows, you know, sometimes those can be fantastic, but sometimes they can also feel a little sad, you know. So I always prefer to catch the band early.
How do you keep your photos fresh? Because I'm sure if you go to a lot of concerts, there must be a little bit of a temptation just to kind of get in the groove and shoot the pictures that you always shoot. Like, how do you find new angles, new perspectives, and make sure that you stay interested and that your audience for the photographs is seeing something new as well?
I think by going to a variety of shows. Like if I only ever shot, say, punk shows, I would start to get bored.
Mm-hmm.
So I branch out, you know, whether it's big venues, tiny venues. I've recently done some rap shows, which was new for me, and I actually really, really enjoyed, and now I kind of feel a hunger for that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some country shows lately, which, again, is not a genre I'm very familiar with, but I just like to branch out and keep it interesting that way. And again, focus on the audiences. And even the audiences have changed over the years, so you have to get creative with that. You have to deal with people holding their phones up instead of just, you know, losing their minds, you know. So it, all of that has changed.
Do you go to concerts yourself and just leave the camera behind ever?
It's really hard for me. It's really hard. It's rare, too. Maybe about one concert a year will I not bring a camera, and that usually is just either because it was someone I really wanted to see, and sometimes they don't grant photo passes. Some artists just don't do it anymore. Or it, you know, whatever the circumstances, it has to be something I really, really want to see for me to go to it without my camera, because mm-hmm. otherwise I'm shooting it in my head the whole time.
If you're shooting something like a smaller setting, like a more intimate setting, or a folk musician, something acoustic, do you worry about the noise of the shutter?
Yeah, that happens too. I know there was something I did recently that I worried about that. Oh, yeah, Lou Barlow. And it was beautiful. There was only about 50 people there. It was just in a living room, but it was so quiet. And it was just Lou and his guitar telling stories and playing. And I was very concerned about my shutter noise at that particular show. So I would take a few shots and then pause and there was moments when the song was quiet or the story he was telling was way too intimate for me to interrupt with a shutter speed, with a shutter click.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wouldn't do it. That was just for those of us here in the room. It doesn't need to be documented. I'll shoot the next song.
So how many nights a week are you out taking photos?
It depends. This is kind of a slow week for me. There hasn't been a whole lot happening. But it could be anywhere from a couple of nights a week to five. Last week, I think there was about four or five nights in a row that I was out. Big venues, small venues, all up and down. So it just depends on who's coming through and what sort of strikes me as interesting.
Do you worry about your hearing at all?
I wear earplugs. I didn't at first, but I have started in probably the past maybe 6 or 7 years being very diligent about that, because I've definitely noticed my hearing is not what it used to be. Especially when you're right up against the speakers and the photo pits. So yeah, I'm always right against the stage.
Getting sweated on by the guitar player.
Yeah. The sweat, the beer, the whatever from the audience members. Oh yeah.
Well, Jen Cray, as a photographer, she takes photos for the Orlando Weekly and others. You can find her on Instagram, jen.cray. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in April last year. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Listener support is our biggest source of fundraising. With your help, we're able to provide the in-depth reporting and thoughtful conversation that you hear on Intersection and elsewhere on 90.7 News. The money we raise from this fund drive will sustain us through fall, so make a contribution by calling 1-800-785-2020 or by clicking on wmfe.org/support. And thanks. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for today's show from Danielle Pryor and Emily Lang. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.